Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about consciousness, the evolution of consciousness, and how we could become, I would say, more of ourselves and meet others in our most natural, organic, wholesome state. And that's why I'm talking tonight to Stan Katkin. His book is called Wired for Love, and his other book is called Wired for Dating. Welcome, Stan, to the show.
Hi, Alan. How are you?
Thanks. So Wired for Love and Wired for Dating, you talk about the neurobiology basically of connection, right? Explain the wiring process and the neurology of this.
My approach is actually, it's called psychobiology. We're looking at not just the development of the personality, but also the beginnings of safety and security from childhood and how that factors into adult romantic relationships. And then we also look at what is true about the brain and the brain when it comes to pair bonding and in being in long-term romantic relationships. So this is very much grounded in research and science, but applied in a folksy way so that people can understand what we're trying to convey, which is we want people to start off and to be in something we call a secure functioning relationship.
So wired means like we are innately conditioned to be loving beings in relationship with companions and family. Is that what you mean by wired?
Wired in the sense that in the beginning, we might imagine that our attachment bonds are dyadic, meaning they're twosomes, starting with mother-infant, and then growing up into adult pair bonding, or, you know, like Adam and Eve. And then we have an offspring, and our job, generally speaking, is to protect each other from the dangerous environment and from predators for at least 4 years. And that's anthropologically, you know, the innate condition of the human animal. And so fast forward that into our current, you know, culture, where people are struggling to stay connected in a long run with somebody, whether it's their, well, should be their partner, but it could be a non-romantic partner, in a way that provides cover for both partners, like being in the foxhole together. And that also allows people not only to survive, but thrive. So in the beginning, we're dyadic. We move into groups of people. We're herd animals, but we still remain fundamentally wired to be in twosomes.
Uh-huh. We're actually wired because of the initial mother bonding creates a psychoneurology of that twosomeness. Is that what you're saying?
That and also we seek that out throughout life. At least one other person with whom we can be tethered, whether that's a best friend or whether that's a lover. Even in polygamous cultures or polyamorous cultures, there generally is a primary partner. Again, going back to we tend to tether to at least one other person strongly.
What if we don't have that initial bonding, if we're orphaned or abandoned or some, you know, we don't have that? How does that affect the rest of our lives?
And that's a great question. In conditions where there is an attachment breach early on, where the baby goes through what with John Bowlby called despair and mother loss depression. If that goes on too long, the baby reemerges. If it doesn't die, reemerges never to really bond with one other person again. And so we have people who will never put all their money on one person. They'll surround themselves with many people, lots of eggs in their basket, never one.
Right. So there's no way of overcoming that with therapy and conditioning, and maybe we don't have to. What do you think? Can people heal that? Or
Well, as a therapist, yes, I believe they can. Are there people who either can't or aren't interested? Yeah, that's true too. I think the condition we worry most about is the people who remain isolated and don't have a social network of any kind. These are the people who go mad. Just like couples, if couples are socially isolated and they don't have a network of friends and family around them, they can go mad as well. We call that a folie à deux. So there is something about the human condition that doesn't fare well in isolation.
So that old saying, it takes a village, you know, to raise a family or even to have a relationship, because the others are sort of adding their input to a kind of, if it's just one-on-one, it gets too intense, there's no outlet or release. Is that the problem?
Well, think of a two-person system as being a sort of a mini society, a social unit, but they're embedded in a larger and sort of concentric circles of social units, right? And so that would be part of the village or the clan or the extended family or the community. And that's, I think, kind of the natural habitat for us humans, is that we form these special bonds, primary bonds, with at least one other person. And then we have concentric circles outside of that, where we are also embedded in a larger social group. And we function best this way. There's another issue here, and that has to do with something we know in the brain called a negativity bias. And that means that, all things being equal, if we were not able to interact with anybody, we would be left with our own mind, which tends to go negative naturally. And one of the reasons it tends to go negative is because we have to be more alert to dangers and more alert to threat in order to survive. That means being by ourselves and being with our mind alone is not a very good place to be without interacting with others. Think of solitary confinement as being a cruel and an unusual punishment, and there's a reason for that. Without interaction with another human being, we're left with our own negativity bias in our brain, and that makes us terrified, depressed, suicidal, all of that stuff.
What about meditation, though? I mean, you know, that's off the subject a little bit, but they say, you know, when you're meditating, you're left with your own mind, you can tap into some higher forces, levels of yourself, and kind of overcome that negativity because you're, you know, going somewhere else in a way.
Well, the great thing about that, and it is wonderful, is that's voluntary. But imagine an involuntary situation where you don't have the choice and it's not time limited, where you're sitting for 10, 20, 30 minutes or a week, and usually in the presence of others if it's a long meditation. So we're talking about being in a non-choiceful situation where you're cut off from interacting with others. That creates a problem. Carl Jung, the famed psychologist, tried this in about, I think it was 1912 or 1914. He decided he would spend a long time with his own unconscious in a cabin along a river, and he went mad. He went crazy. And then when he came out of that thing, he wrote, basically, don't do that. It's not a good idea to be alone with your unconscious that long. Mm-hmm. So it's a difference between a discipline where you're learning how to work with your own mind, which meditation should be, and a forced situation where you have no other outlet.
Right. Now, in your latest book, Wired for Dating, because a lot of people are looking to be in relationship, are there some basic, you have some myths here that I would love to go over.
Sure.
Because, some of them go against what I've learned, you know. Myth one, love is all you need to make a relationship. I always thought that was true, you know, that love will, if there's enough love, enough connection, it should be enough for a relationship.
Yeah, unfortunately, this is not true.
It's not.
it's not. Love certainly is a component that makes people want to be together, but it's easily destroyed if people don't guard against this and form a relationship based on principles of fairness, justice, and sensitivity. So all things being equal, love gets you into a relationship, but it doesn't necessarily sustain one. It's the way people behave towards each other. It's the agreements they set up, like being in a foxhole together. They have each other's backs. They protect each other in public and private. They tell each other everything. They're the go-to people. They're basically doing things for each other that nobody else wants to do because people are basically burdens and they're each other's burden. And that's the quid pro quo. Out of that comes a generating feeling of love that's being renewed again and again, along with certain skillfulness like making use of gazing into the eyes. That engenders feelings of love. But to expect that love is going to carry the day, it's not true, because remember that negativity bias I talked about. Our brains are built more for war than for love. We are tweaked to pick up negative experiences and feelings more than we are positive ones. That means that it is quite easy and even inevitable that you and I in a relationship are going to build up more threat than feelings of love if we're not careful. And of course, threat will smash love.
Wait, so how do we avoid that? How do we avoid building up those feelings of negativity?
By understanding that we're in a two-person relationship where we depend on each other, where one of us goes, so goes the other. If I don't think of you as being in my care and myself as being in your care, then we're liable to behave in ways that are unfair, unjust, or insensitive. In other words, one-person systems tend to rely on the self at the cost of relationship. Two-person systems put the relationship first, and the selves survive and thrive in the umbrella of that safety and security. It's like an ecosystem. So you and I would have to agree, this is like a social contract, that we're going to do things for each other that ensure safety and security. We care whether the other person gets hurt. We fix things really fast. I care if you think that the nod of my head or the change in my voice sounds dismissive or demeaning to you, and I fix that. So we're talking about not taking for granted the fact that we're animals and that we have to really know each other very, very well to know how to handle each other. We have to be, you know, our partner's whisperer, so to speak. You've heard of dog whisperers and horse whisperers. Well, you know, if you and I were a couple, I'd have to be your whisperer. I know exactly who you are and how you work, and I guard your vulnerability very carefully. So we're talking about the opposite of what people mostly do. And that is take an idea that I'm in it for myself. It has to be good for me, and if it's not good for you, then sorry.
So, but that takes a level of surrendering to the other person, trusting, becoming like totally available to the other person.
Well, on some level, yes. But if you want to put it into practical terms, if we were, you know, if we were in the jungle and there were predators around, you and I would be very attentive, not only to our environment, but to each other, because our lives depend on it. It's us against the world. We are protecting each other. If we were cop car partners, we'd be doing the same. If we were Navy SEALs, we'd be doing the same. If we were in a country, God forbid, where bombs were raining down on us, do you think we'd be arguing about whether we are each other's soulmate? No, we'd be busy protecting each other. And so there's a very practical aspect to this, a realization that being together and caring for each other serves a very important biological and survival purpose. And unfortunately, in our culture, we're so far away from that, fortunately and unfortunately, that we don't really get it.
Well, I mean, it's also very beautiful to be there for each other, to be there for somebody, to take care and make sure their well-being is taken care of. I mean, that's That's the beautiful part of relationships.
It is, and it's the rewarding part, and it's the only way that it makes sense. That you are in my care, I'm in your care, and this is how it works, which goes against some prevailing ideas that we have in our culture, having to do with autonomy, and I have to take care of myself first, and I have to look out for me.
Right.
In love relationships, that turns out to be very threatening.
I was going to ask you about that myth number three. You have to learn to take care of yourself before you can start to take care of others. I mean, so you're saying that's not true.
No, if you look developmentally, a baby doesn't come out of the womb and the mother doesn't say, you know, I have to take care of myself, baby, and you have to take care of yourself. That's not going to work. Or say to the baby, baby, you have to learn to love yourself before I'll love you. The baby learns to love by being loved. Right. We learn to love another. We learn to love ourselves by loving another very well. We learn about ourselves by knowing another person very well. So these things are intertwined, but it's nonsense to think that it's done in a vacuum. It's impossible. It defies everything we know about human development.
Well, how did you learn that for yourself? I mean, lots of people don't know that. How did you figure that out?
By studying mother-infant pairs. There was a time when I was in that business in my field of doing prevention work. I wanted to work early with these early relationships with the baby, whose trajectory can be changed very easily, very quickly by making minor tweaks with the adults. And so, so by studying infants and infant development, one gets to understand adults.
Did you lose you?
Did you lose me? Oh, no. Oh, no. Hello.
No, I got you. Just for a second. We lost you for a second. You're back. It's okay.
Oh, dear.
Okay. So you're saying, okay, go ahead. We just lost a sentence there.
Do you remember where I left off? So I told
you. In your studies with babies and your observations, you realize something that.
Yes. I mean, if you study primates or humans, you study babies, you understand adults. We are, in fact, babies, even though we are adult as well. We still have infant needs, even though we are adults. And the rules still apply in terms of how we get a sense of ourselves. It's always an interaction with another person. It's never in isolation, ever.
Right. Now, looking at your book, this is myth number five, is one that I've really had a problem with. And that's what's gotten in the way of my dating, is I need to find my soulmate. I know that's ridiculous, but that's something on my mind. What do you say about that?
Well, first of all, there are billions of people on the planet.
Right.
The idea that you have a single soulmate would be not only ridiculous, but it would be very hopeless because, oh my God, how am I going to find that person among the masses?
Well, so it's like the perfect person, I guess, is what I'm really have some fantasy about, right?
Yes. Well, we all do. But in actuality, it's the good enough person that we seek. The good enough person, like us, because we're only good enough, nobody is perfect, comes with all sorts of messiness, because there is no person on the planet that isn't annoying or irritating or high maintenance at some point. Everybody
really?
Is. So to think that that other person is going to be easy is going to come as a shock, because there's nothing more difficult on the planet than another person. So whether that person I think is my soulmate or not, they're going to be hard. Now, how many people out there that I could call my soulmate? Well, I'd have to try a lot of different people. But in point of fact, there are many people out there that are suitable for me, but they're all good enough. They're not perfect. And anybody who seems perfect will not remain that way, because people are imperfect and difficult. And so it's just a fallacy. People who are looking for that are looking for a unicorn, and also dismissing and devaluing the person they're with.
But what if they are yes, that's probably true, but what do you say to somebody if they are looking for how do you get people over that sort of obsessive sort of need for perfection? I mean, how do you work with people, you as a therapist, as someone dealing with that?
By working in the relationship, if somebody is in a relationship, then I always want to work with the relationship. If they are not in one, then I love working with people individually to get them into one. And so I can work with those issues in the relationship with me. But basically, this is a learning by doing. And we learn about what is important and what is realistic and what is possible as we go through life, or we suffer. Looking for perfection or trying to be perfect is a good way to suffer throughout your life. Because we're basically dealing with ideas in our heads. I don't know if you know this, but we've never lived outside of our heads, and we never will. So that person that you're looking for that's perfect is actually you. It's not really another person. Another person is a pain in the ass. So but not the person we're thinking about, because who spends their night dreaming about the perfect ideal pain in the ass? Nobody. But yet that is what a person is. And so we have to understand that our image is not the same as a real person. People are always more difficult than that. And once I think we understand that, then we're on a better footing towards having a really good relationship.
Right. So most people live in a fantasy of what that person should be, as opposed to the reality of who people are.
Yeah, you're not going to you're never going to comply to my image of you. My image of you is changing all the time according to my mood, my state. This goes to the way the brain works. Is my memory is always state dependent. So my memory of you and my past and other people changes according to my current state of mind. Now, along with that, my perceptions change also. So suddenly I'm in a certain mood, I'm remembering certain things, and you become unattractive to me. I'm finding fault with you all the time. I'm in another state of mind and my memory is different, my perceptions are different, and now I can't find anything wrong with you. But these are mind tricks. They're not really happening outside of me. In point of fact, people are just being people, and I am changing how I feel and see things and hear things according to my internal state. Now, true, our relationship is constantly changing that state, but I have to remember that real people are never going to be as predictable as my mind. It's my image.
Well, maybe I'll do a session with you about that.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm sort of have some idea that, I don't know, that's in the way somehow. Because, you know, I do date and, you know, Wired for Dating, I think, is a very practical book. And, you know, the subtitle is How to Understand Neurobiology and Attachment Style Can Help You Find Your Ideal Mate. So the ideal mate really is this, is something in ourselves, that some understanding about the reality of the other person. There's no ideal mate in the sense.
No.
Right.
There's so, good enough.
You're good enough mate.
There's good enough. But I must say, good enough is great.
Yes. Especially if there's nothing there, right? I mean, especially, you know.
Well, compared to perfection, good enough is great, because perfection always leads to disappointment.
Right, but is there something artificial about dating in general? I mean, it's sort of a new phenomena, I would think. I mean, maybe the animal kingdom has some form of it, but in the human culture, I think people were assigned marriages, or I don't know. It just seems like a very artificial sort of way of finding a mate, but maybe that's the only thing that exists. I don't know.
Well, we do have this is a different time, and I think there are built-in problems to our particular time, where technology has become addictive, and so has the dating technology, where I can swipe left or right. I can, you know, I can. It's like a slot machine becomes addictive. I can constantly look for someone, never really sticking with anybody, and this then becomes a problem of its own. Whereas before, you'd have maybe one or two choices. And some of those choices were made for you by your clan, which, by the way, is not entirely bad, because at least the clan is picking somebody who is familiar and even familial, which is something, by the way, you do naturally. We always pick somebody, if we're going to be in a long-term relationship, we always pick somebody who is familiar, familial, and we recognize that person. We don't pair bond with strangers. Now, nature does want us to procreate, and nature does not care about long-term relationship. So if I meet you in a bar, I am going to just want to procreate. I want to have sex. I don't care whether you're a long-term relationship contender or not. So there's a big difference between that early courtship infatuation phase when you're on drugs and the idea of settling in with somebody in a interdependent relationship. Those are two different things.
So how do you deal with the modern technology of dating? You know, it is, I mean, it's as easy as swiping left or right, but it's not really that easy deciding, because there's always another pretty face there or something else. I mean, it's actually more confusing in a way.
It is. There have been several studies on happiness in the human brain, and it turns out that we do not like a lot of choices. We may say we do, but we're not happy that way, because we don't get settled in that sense. We're constantly looking for a way to take that item back, 30-day return, right? We want to constantly exchange things because we're still looking for something better. That is a way to be unhappy. We're happiest when we have one or two choices. We make the choice, and then we invest everything into that choice, whether it is a car or it's a career or whether it's a whatever it is, but a person especially. So I pick you. I've decided to take you as you are. I'm going to put all my money on you. That now is off the table. I don't need to spend resources thinking about that anymore. I am truly free. But if I am someone who is always on the fence, and you could be somebody else who's better, my resources are taken up with that, and I can't be happy, and I can't do anything else. Mm-hmm. So it's really a bad thing for us in terms of how our brain operates.
Right. So what do you do for those people if they're in that habit of thinking that they can't decide, it's always this and that? I mean, how do you work with that?
Well, the same thing, people who can't decide on a career. There's a point at which you decide. And you decide and you go all in, because the only way you know whether something can work is by going all in. That's a leap of faith. That's hard for people to do because they want a sure thing, and there is no sure thing. Every decision I make, there's a loss. And so if I don't realize that, then I will be frozen in a decision. And that's where I will stay. That's not a happy place to be.
So you go all, you find somebody, whatever, you put up with their imperfections, and you go all in, and it either works or it might not work, right? I mean,
who knows, but at least you're all in, and that's the only way to find out. And before you go thinking that the other person isn't perfect, it's also important to take stock and realize that we're no cakewalk, right? You know, if my partner is a burden, I am too. Mm-hmm. And maybe we should have vows that say, I take you as my pain in the ass and you take me as your pain in the ass. I mean, that should be it, because anything else, I think it's fantasy. We're burdens.
No. I was just thinking, because I mean, I was just going to say, sometimes you see these people who are totally in love, and they, you know, that's the ideal relationship, and you say, yes, that it's possible, but of course, you don't know what goes on behind closed doors either, right?
No, you don't. It's hard to assess couples from the outside because people lie, and you can't be in the bedroom with them and hear them at every moment. But we do know what makes relationships work, and we do know certain things that are guaranteed to cause a failure in a relationship. So those things are pretty well known and understood.
Well, can you just go over some of the things that makes a relationship work? I mean, I know you've talked about it so far, but is there a list?
Relationships, at least in our culture, because other cultures operate differently in terms of justice and fairness. But generally speaking, in our culture, a relationship that is fully collaborative and truly mutual is one that's set to work better than those that are not. Therefore, we understand that we're individuals, but we depend on each other and we're tied together. Therefore, where one of us goes, so goes the other. Mm-hmm. Understanding that our relationship is like a three-legged race. You know those three-legged races in picnics? You know, you put your both you put your legs in a potato sack. If I go down, you go down. And this is a reality. And understanding that sets the stage for a kind of a mutuality where we collaborate and we agree to do things that are good for both of us and not just one of us. Those are the kind of relationships that are likely to survive because they are based on principles of fairness, justice, and sensitivity. The relationships that are not organized in that way are going to fail because they're too unfair. I look out for myself. I take care of my own interests. I need to be right. I am not a team player unless it suits me. So these relationships where we do what we want without regard to the other person or the relationship itself are doomed to fail because somebody is going to get hurt repeatedly. And if we don't repair things, this is going to escalate into what we think of as a biological threat system where we begin to get more and more predatory towards each other and then we leave.
Right. I get that. So in combining your two books, Wired for Love, Wired for Dating, how do you get from dating to deciding, okay, you go out a couple of dates, you like this person. How do you go from there to saying, okay, let's go for it? And maybe one person is more hesitant what's that step?
Well, first of all, Wired for Dating is all about prevention, since I'm big on prevention. My intention there is to do in an early phase what I try to do after the fact in working with couples that have been together for a while. Their relationships could have been predicted in the beginning based on the way they structured the relationship, could be predicted that it would fail. So rather than go back and try to redo or to fix a relationship, it's great to think about starting off on the right foot. And so the book is filled with ideas about what people should be looking for. And instead of thinking about the person, what relationship do you want? What should the relationship be? What's the point of it anyway? Why should you even be coupled? What do you do for each other that you couldn't hire somebody to do? I think you have to start with, why are you even doing it? And if it's because, well, this is my soulmate, or because we're in love, or because we're attracted to each other, or because we have the same things in common, that's going to work for a good hot minute. It's not going to last a lifetime or even for several years. It has to be based on something more. You and I believe in a third thing called our relationship, which is structured in a way that not only protects us, but serves us, allows us to be better than we ordinarily would be. This is a thoughtful process. So rather than looking for that person, I expect a certain kind of relationship that's based on certain ideals and principles. Are you willing to do that? Are you interested in that too? That ends up being more important than whether you like tennis or whether you are handsome to me or whether, you understand? Understand
yeah,
what I'm saying?
No, I think that's a really important point. And let me just see if I can absorb it, is saying that in order for this relationship to work, we have to make it, we have to know that the relationship is something that will do something for us to move us along in our life. Did I understand that right?
Yes. We agree on the basic principles that we both believe at this point in time serves both of our interests. And that overrides our personality and our moods. We do these things because we believe in them, not because we feel like it. If we do everything according to what we feel like, we're going to step on each other's toes repeatedly. So, you know, how do two people who are different get together and form a society, a mini society? They believe in certain principles that they can both live by, that supports life, that enhances life, and we do it because we can. This is an adult decision. That's more of a mature kind of relationship than what most people are seeking or thinking about.
Wait, but it's still, I'm still trying to absorb it. So, because I think it's really important and deep key to making it work and making it not work as all those other reasons you said. Yes, we both like tennis and football. And so...
Can I add something, Alan?
Yeah. Yes.
Consider this. You and I never talked about whether we should be fully transparent with each other. Now, we could have talked about it, that we believe, let's agree, you and I, that we're going to tell each other everything for the right reasons. The reason being that if we pick each other, why not allow each other to know everything we can so we're not alone in the world? Why wouldn't I use you as my partner to know me better than I know myself? I have nothing to hide. I don't want to hide. That takes up resources. So let's agree to just be fully transparent. Now, we don't have that conversation, but let's go down the line about 5 years, and you've just held information from me about seeing somebody else or money or something. You didn't tell me. And I complained because I thought, you know, you would tell me everything, but we never talked about this. So I'm complaining about something we never agreed on, and now we have the discussion, which I see all the time in my office. I'll ask the couple, do you guys believe that you should be able to tell each other everything? Do you believe in full transparency? One person says, absolutely, and the other person says, no. Well, wouldn't that be a deal breaker in the beginning?
Yeah. So what do you do in that case? What do you do as a counselor? You say this isn't going to work, or do you say, well, you have to agree to be transparent, or I mean, how do you deal with that?
Well, as a therapist, I have to say I don't have a dog in that race, because what I care about is whether the couple is operating in a truly mutual fashion, whether they agree. But people like to bend reality. They like to kick the can down the road. They don't want to lose anything now. They'll defer, and they'll just ignore it, and then the cows come – or the chickens come – mixing metaphors here. Then the chickens come home to roost, yeah. And suddenly I'm surprised that you didn't tell me things. Well, because I went along with something knowing this person does not believe in that same thing. So bad on me. But that is a deal breaker that should have been realized early. Now it's a matter for them to work that out. Is this going to be a deal breaker or not? Both have a right. The person who doesn't believe they should be transparent is perfectly within their rights. There's nothing wrong with that. Just as the person who wants full transparency is nothing wrong with that. But that's something they should have decided early.
Well,
this is what people don't do.
Well, it seems like that you promote transparency for, I mean, it seems like that's what, if you're relying on that person, if you're in the foxhole together, then wouldn't you expect transparency from what you're saying, right? I mean, isn't that part of it?
Well, if they can defend it, more power to them. But a follow-up question would be, okay, so then what should the two of you know and what shouldn't you know? And people generally will hoist themselves on their own petard when having this talk, because ultimately what happens is it exposes a one person's psychological think. In other words, I want to do what serves me, but I don't really think about what will serve the relationship. And that's really what it comes down to. What it'll expose is that I don't really value collaboration in that way. I like to keep my things secret. I like to keep a part of me away. I'm within my rights to do that, but it's not really consistent with a safe and secure relationship in the long run.
Right. So you wouldn't recommend that. You would recommend transparency. I think is what you're saying.
I think if anybody poses the questions to these two people, they will generally come to the conclusion themselves, because we have to then say, well, what shouldn't you know, or what would you keep from your partner? Ultimately, somebody says, well, important things. Then you have to ask, well, what's important?
Yeah.
Things I think he should know. Well, what about you're deciding the things that he should know? But what if those things are very important to your partner? So these things naturally work out when people think about it. But in the book, what I'm trying to get people to do is to think, to think ahead, to pick their partner, not according to the partner themselves exactly, but what vision does that partner have that's like your vision for a relationship?
Right. No, but it's interesting what you were just saying, because I was talking to this woman the other night and she said, you know, if I was in a relationship with you, I wouldn't want you she wouldn't want to know if I was like off with other people. She just wouldn't want to know that, you know? And I thought that was interesting.
It's interesting, and it puts herself in jeopardy, because I wouldn't want to know something puts you in jeopardy in the long run. I'd rather both of us be in a position where we don't have to worry or think about any of that stuff.
Right.
We have resources now to spare for other things like work, creativity, self-growth. I don't have to keep thinking about what I shouldn't tell you.
Right.
I don't want to do that. I want to be myself, and I want you to be yourself, and I want us to be able to not walk on eggshells. I want us to be able to fight and work together without fear.
Because your myth number four says you shouldn't rely on only one person for your well-being. So you're saying it's okay to rely on one person for your well-being.
I think that what I said before is that the smallest unit of our idea of society is a two-person system. And then we expand beyond that. So to be only reliant on one other person isn't good either. But to say that I cannot tell you things because I want to spread that information out amongst my friends is a problem, because the primary relationship that you and I have, whether we like it or not, is primary. It means that we are executives, the roof of the house, the top of the food chain. Neither of us are going to appreciate being subordinated by other people or other things. Therefore, this is honoring, which I think anybody can find out for themselves. We don't like being relegated to a third wheel or being demoted or being thrown under the bus. Therefore, there has to be a certain amount of integrity, a certain priority, that this relationship between you and I comes first, and then there are all the other people.
Right. No, I agree, and that makes sense. And are there any signs of, though, if you're getting to know someone, that this person is definitely not someone who I can be with, who's sort of even like, you know, unrelatable psychologically? I mean, some people are. I mean, most people are pretty normal. But what is there anything we could look for saying, well, this person maybe can have a relationship? You know what I'm saying?
If they can't have a relationship, then what are we doing with them unless we can't have one either? So this again goes to, what kind of relationship do we want? Think of a primary relationship as being home. Is this the person we want to be home with? Is this the person that we can be ourselves fully with? Is this the person we can say things freely, given that we're not reckless? Is this the person that we can have excitement with, we can relax and have quiet with? Is this the person we can grow with, that we can be each other's therapist with, that we can be in each other's care with? Is this the person that I would trust with my life because I decide I will do that? If they're not, then there's reason to hesitate and look elsewhere.
Yeah, but how long does it take to know if that person is that? I mean, you have a day.
About a year.
A year.
About a year.
No, I think that's fair. I mean, yeah, it has to take a while. If you think you know it on the first date, then you have some problems, right?
You can't know somebody on the first date. On a first date, second date, third date, first month, first 2 months, you're in relationship primarily with yourself. That other person is not yet a real person. You're still infatuated with the image or the idea of that person. That's everybody. But eventually you're going to get to know that person, and your fantasies are going to be replaced with reality. That's when the rubber hits the road. And that's when all these fancy drugs that we're on when we're infatuated start to wear off.
That's when the honeymoon's over, right?
That's when the honeymoon is over. And now we become deep family. Now we become proxies for everybody that came before. Now we become as difficult as we really are. And what got us there was the infatuation. That's great, right? But now we've moved into another phase, a reality, which is actually quite wonderful, if it is a reality we can live with.
Well, do you reckon? Yeah, right. And how do we know if it's a reality we can live with or not? How do we know that?
I think in the first year, by the end of a year, we pretty much are getting to know that other person. If somebody is in a relationship for 3 years and they're still cherry picking and they're still, you know, saying, well, I don't know because there's this part of this person, then it's really time to move on. It's unfair to keep somebody in an audition mode for 3 years. I think by that time we know enough. But before a year, it's a little bit hazy. It takes a while to really get to know someone. You have your fights. You know what it's like to depend on that person. And you've taken them around to your peeps, you know, male and female friends and families for vetting. This ensures that you're not just reacting to a biological drive, that people are seeing the two of you fit within the society you live in, within the culture you have. This is why, by the way, that many arranged marriages actually work, because the family is vetting these partners just as you would do it out in the wild. The difference is that the same things, the same problems that befall arranged marriages are what, happen to marriages where you choose somebody, in a dating situation. The same things, same problems.
Well, but live for a year, is this year with this person a living situation? I mean, when do you move in together? Is that after a year or is that part of the year, would you say?
Yeah. I'm not so interested in when people move in, because I know that there comes a time when people begin to view the other person as being permanent, or at least the fantasy of being permanent. And that's when the fun begins. Everything that I'm afraid of or has not yet been worked out, having to do with depending on another person, now surfaces and becomes real. To the degree that I've not resolved those fears is the degree to which I will continue to play them out in this relationship. That's just nature. That's not pathology. That's what we all do. And so that's why, that's when, quote unquote, the fun begins. And it's not really fun for a lot of people, because now we're dealing with family, you see.
Right, with our projections, with our unresolved relationships to our parents. And
exactly. As soon as I depend on you, mm-hmm. I begin to remember that I get abandoned as soon as I feel hope. I get abandoned as soon as I depend. Or I get co-opted and engulfed and smothered when I depend. All these things from my memory are going to happen now because they're not yet fixed. And this is where couples can either help each other or make it worse.
Well, that's it. So how do you use that relationship in a positive way to fix the incomplete parts of your past, as opposed to taking it out on? I mean, what do you recommend for that?
By understanding, again, it goes back to this idea of the really, these are big ideas I'm trying to provide, yeah. Not the small ones, the big ideas which govern decisions. If you and I realize that we're in each other's care, and that we picked each other not by accident, but by familiarity, by recognition, and that we are, by definition, difficult and burdensome, then we kind of get closer to understanding our purpose. My job is to be there to minister to you when that injury arises, even though I'm the target of it. I have to fix that with you. You fix that with me, or I contribute to it. See, a lot of this has to do with the grand idea of how do we envision relationship. If I think going into this, when you get upset with me, and if I think you are projecting onto me, which is natural, and I say, hey, you know, Alan, don't project onto me. That's not me. That's your father. That's a mistake, because in this kind of relationship, it's all projection. Who should you project onto if not me? So that complaint is rejecting and dismissive. I'm it. Therefore, I'm the one who fixes it. I can't send you back to your father. He's dead or he's changed. It's me now. Am I going to fix that, or am I going to complain and do the very same thing that was done earlier? Do you understand?
No, I understand. But usually the two feed off each other. You're doing this to me, like your neediness fits irritates my thing of wanting to be alone and not smothered. So that feeds off each other and develops into the conflict where both people are getting exactly what they don't want, you know?
And yet there is the joke in nature. The very thing that I chose about you that I want is going to be the thing I complain most about.
Mm. So how do you deal? I mean, yes, so someone, I know, I get it, but how do you come to terms with that? Because that's really what the core of working through relationships seems to be about, that projection of that incompleteness, and that offends something in me that then offends something in you. So right. Where do you go to from there to sort of fix the whole thing?
It starts with repair. We all have reflexes. We all react reflexively according to memory. We may not be able to do anything about the reflex per se, but we can do something after we've done something that hurts the other person. You know what? I'm sorry I yelled at you. I'm sorry that I called you needy. It's just that it freaks me out sometimes. I start to worry that I'm going to get smothered, and I know you're not intending to do that. I'm sorry for pushing you away or being angry. This is the beginning of love and repair and security. This is the stuff of security. It's not in being perfect. It's messing up and being willing to repair, make it right, fix things in a way that works and that's quick and doesn't waste time. This has always been the mana of love, of security. If we go back to the teachers in this area, like Donna Winnicott, who studied mother infants, it's the good enough mother. The good enough mother makes mistakes. She can't be perfect because that's a bad mother. The good enough mother makes all sorts of errors, but is willing to correct them and to make them right. That's love. That's security. That's something we all can do.
Oh, wait, that's a really new point for me. I mean, I'm sure I've heard it somewhere, but the willingness to say, okay, I'm not perfect and I can work through it. And yes, that was a button you pushed, and let's look at that. I think that's really important to have two people that agree upon that, right?
Let's just repair it. We don't have to look at it so much as we have responsibility to fix what we break. And here it gets into the whole thing again of what comes first, the relationship or my own self-interests. If my own self-interests come first, then I have to say good luck, because that's going to blow back on me. If the relationship comes first, and this goes for early childhood too, if the relationship comes first, I care more about that than being right. I care more about that than anything else. And so I will do what's necessary to put things back together again, because I can't bear for the relationship to suffer. this is what it's all about. And this is what I'm trying to impart with people. This is not a new idea, but it is a sound idea. We have people who are looking out for themselves and become embattled because their position is threatening. Just that position of taking your own interests, defending yourself, being in it for yourself is threatening. We're trying to get people to understand that in love relationships, it cannot work that way. We have to put the relationship first. And that becomes the Holy Grail. That becomes like a religion, to serve God, to serve the relationship. That guides us. And that allows us to eat crow, lay down for the good of the relationship. It's been done over the span of humankind. And it demonstrates that there's something greater than myself. And that's the relationship I chose and I created. It's mine. It's yours. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
We have to change the way people envision this.
I get that. I get that. But it has that, the relationship idea has to come when you know that person is going in it as totally as you are, right?
Yes, and that goes back to my earlier point about dating and prevention. You and I agree about the important things.
Right.
In the beginning, or we don't do it.
And those important things would be something basic, or it's anything we agree upon. What are the important things to you?
We agree that the relationship comes first above and beyond everything else.
Above our own needs. Would you say that?
Yes, but we get our own needs met when we put the relationship first.
Okay. Well, that's because, the hard part.
Because imagine you and I are on the ocean and we're balancing on a board. We have to pay attention to each other. We have to realize that our survival depends on each other. For if one of us takes our eyes off the ball or just does what we want to do, we both die. That's Darwinian. The world, nature doesn't care about that. That's just what happens when we don't take it seriously. The same thing in love relationships. We are tied together. Where one of us goes, so goes the other. Everything I do to hurt you will come back at me. Everything I do that helps you will come back at me. This is just the nature of things. And so if we understand that we depend on each other in order to survive and thrive, then we take this very seriously and we don't act recklessly, impulsively, indifferently to the person upon whom we depend. Do you understand? This is an idea that is really, if we think about it, is just good sense.
Right. But it seems like that's like, okay, that's the first level. The second level, maybe this is how I'm hearing it, is to then see that person's stuff as our reflection, or are we working through, you know, once we establish that and then we get to the level where we work through the damaged parts of ourselves or the incomplete parts of ourselves, then do we reach the next level, or are we always working through something?
We're always growing together. We're always moving through time together. This is what makes a relationship worthwhile and interesting and purposeful, is that we're doing things for each other that ordinarily we'd have to pay a lot of money for, like a therapist, but we do it for each other. We help each other at night suffer the existential fears that we all are vulnerable to. What helps us do this? Well, we tether together. We contact each other. We stay together. We hold together. We hug each other at night. We are what the existentialists, envision. We are two boats separate in the ocean, but we are together. In that separateness, we hold together, we use each other as we go through this life with all the scary things and all the unknowns that are coming down the pike. We can handle it because we have agreements that allow us to hold steady and to stay firm even when the weather gets very rough. This is a resolve, you see. This is a reckoning, an understanding for how things should be, and it's quite naturalistic.
No, and there's more stability when two of those ships hold together.
Absolutely.
Okay,
and I gotta tell you, Alan, we do a lot of research in this area. We have evidence of street people who are secure functioning who do this. They're crazy. Both of them are, you know, have mental illness. But when you look at them as a couple, whether they're romantic or not romantic, they are secure functioning. They get it. We see people from all walks of life do this, whether, like I said, they're in the military or paramilitary. They are, in a situation where they have to agree to hold together. This is not a unicorn. This exists. We see it all the time. But many times it's because the environment forces them into this situation or the culture expects it. We don't have a culture that expects this.
But can you only do this with one person, go that deep, or is it possible to do with more than one person?
I think it starts first with one person. If it's with a group of people, then one must wonder whether it's real. Mm-hmm. The problems that we experience in our earliest relationship reflect the stability, the safety, and security of the first, most primary one. If that relationship is disturbed and we don't get any repair throughout life, then we still conduct ourselves in relationships that are equally insecure and not well. Mm-hmm. Do you follow what I'm saying? So the real test is another person.
Yeah.
You know, I see a lot of people who live a monastic life that I admire. They're able to do things on their own that are extremely admirable. But yet, when they get back with another person, they find themselves just as troubled as anybody else because of that thing I told you. There's nothing more difficult on the planet than another person.
Right.
You know, our imagination of a conversation is one thing. The real conversation is wild because you're working with another nervous system that's moving faster than you can think. Real time is extremely fast. So this interactive process between two human beings is no small feat. It is filled with errors. It is filled with threatening cues. It is only our ability to interact with another person in real time and to deal with conflict in an effective way that really says, that really speaks to social emotional intelligence, right? It's mm-hmm. in real time dealing with people, not in our heads and not in practice.
So that's sort of the key, it seems like, to your work, dealing with conflict in an effective way, which frees us really from our past conditioning.
Did
you say that?
Ultimately, yes. We're hurt by other people and we're healed by other people.
Mm.
And so the hope is always, whether it's a lover or a therapist or a priest, rabbi, or a best friend, there's always hope that those injuries in relationship that we carry with us will be repaired in the next relationship.
Okay. Well, thank you, Stan. That was a great...
This was fun. Thank you. Your questions are great.
Well, I'm using my own life and my own experiences, you know, to try to figure out what I want and who I am and, you know, what type of relationship I would like to have. So,
well, maybe I should have used myself a little bit more here mm-hmm. because I, you know, my wife and I have been through this, you know, in a previous marriage, and we've learned a lot from our own failures. And this idea of agreeing to things and to doing it better is much of my experience in my own marriage as anything else, academically or through research. My own life has been a laboratory. My own experience with my daughter, the fights we have, the reconciliations, the buttons that are pushed, and the repairs that we make are all a part of this experience that I'm talking about.
Is it never ideal, like, oh, honey, it's a beautiful day, and we're just going to be in love forever. I mean, can it ever be that way? That's a pure fantasy, isn't it?
No, we will be in love forever is not the right thing to say. Right. But to say to you and to look at you and to say just what you need to hear, to look at you and to value you every day in a way that is important to you, not to me, but to you, is what keeps that feeling going. Eye contact, face-to-face, skin-to-skin, keeps that feeling going. Repairing injuries and taking that seriously keeps the feeling going. Being interested, present, attentive to your partner keeps the feeling going. This is better than words. This is day-to-day real experience that happens that actually creates and recreates the feeling of love and bonding. This is a practice.
Valuing the other person, what you said there just really stood out. And I think if we could do that, that creates, at least for me, that's a strong bond.
Yes.
I feel valued and I can value the other person and want to be with them because I do value them, you know?
And they care enough about the relationship and you to make, to do whatever is necessary to ensure not just their well-being, but your well-being. Again, people in these relationships are tied together. They're not working in a vacuum. They're completely tied together. And as soon as people understand that, I think it's better.
So in your first marriage and your wife's first marriage, you didn't know about this. So is that what you were saying? And you just sort of acted out? And
oh, I was an idiot. I was immature, selfish. I did all the things that I learned from through regret. You know, we learn by regret. We lose something that we can't recapture. And if we can feel regret, that's the best incentive for never doing those things again and to doing better. So I know in my life, in my past relationships, I have plenty to regret. But my salvation is doing it better today.
So when you're this with your current wife partner, you made certain agreements because of your past experiences that you knew helped make the relationship more important than your individual needs.
Yes, and I have to say my wife is more secure than I am, so she's been the leader in this.
Oh, what do you mean?
I think I'm by far the most difficult person compared to her.
More secure in what way is she?
I think she came to the table more secure from the beginning than I was. She pulled me more into security than I did her.
What does that mean, security? I'm not sure what you mean by security.
More free to be herself, less encumbered by fears of abandonment, less encumbered by fears of engulfment, less encumbered by fears in an interdependent relationship than I. And so I have to say that she was a better model for pulling me into secure functioning than I was. But I wasn't far behind. I just wasn't there. And so we can pull each other into secure functioning. We can also pull each other into insecurity as well. It can go either way.
I guess it takes intelligence and that understanding of people, what people's needs are, and that sometimes they can act out and not even be aware of their needs. And
yeah.
And so I just think it takes compassion and time and like all you said, awareness.
Awareness, and I really want to drive the point home because in my books, even though there's a lot of nerdy science things and brain stuff, but I'm really trying to get across big ideas. I think everything stems really from big ideas. And
what do you mean by big ideas? Like the big ideas we've been talking about?
Yes, the idea of secure functioning, which is something that is you're not born into, but something you create with another human being by agreement. That this is attainable by every soul on the planet. And again, I have evidence for this. So this is something that is obtainable, but it comes with an attitude and an idea. Basic ideas of relating and survival and that guide our behavior. Too many books, too many speakers out there are talking about tools, But the tools mean nothing if you don't have the theory. If you don't understand the nature of relationship in people, tools are not going to work. The tools are only as good as the person wielding them understands the purpose and the basic game that they're playing. The game here is that we are in the foxhole together. It's us against the world. We are looking out for each other because ultimately we're the only two people that care. The world does not. Therefore, we better watch out. We better have each other's backs, and we better make each other so important that we have each other's owner's manual or we suffer the consequences.
Right. No, it reminds me of that famous poem about love. You know that about the Cliffs of Dover? You know that one?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't recite it. But
I can't recite it either. Yeah. Love, let us be true to one another or something like that.
Yes.
Yeah. But thank you. Thank you for your time. And how can people find you?
They can find me at my website or one website, stantatkin.com, or thepactinstitute.com. That's for therapists who are looking for training. And you can follow me at Dr. Stan Tatkin. That's my handle on Twitter. And I'm also all over Facebook. I'm all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Oh, this is the poem. Can I just read it and see?
Please, yeah.
This is by, what's his name? Arnold. Is it Matthew Arnold? The Dover Beach. And the last line is, love, let us be true to one another, for the world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy nor love nor light, nor certitude nor peace nor help from pain. And we lie here as on a darkened plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash at night.
Mm.
So, I mean,
that's nice.
Yeah, it's nice. That's, and it kind of talks about what you're saying about let us be true to love, which is the relationship, which will ultimately give us what I think we've come here for.
Yes.
And which is also to work through, I would even say, the karmic situations in order to regain a sense of ourselves.
Yes.
So,
and it's all interpersonal. We are relational, interpersonal beings. We require interaction. That's how we are. That's how we roll.
And then it's our neurology as well, you're saying.
It's in our DNA.
Where are you located, you said?
We live in Calabasas. My office is in Agoura Hills, but I am a professor at UCLA in family medicine, and that is located at a hospital here. But other than that, I'm traveling around with my wife. We have an training institute, where we train therapists in my approach called a psychobiological approach to couple therapy.
Oh, so you and your wife are both therapists in that way?
No, she handles me. She's a philanthropist, so she manages me. She's the brains behind the operation. I am the lowly talent behind this.
Okay. Well, thank you for your time. I'd love to do can we do like a little session at some point?
Sure, I'd love to.
Okay, we'll do something like that. I'll let you know. I'll let Beth, your PR person. Beth.
Okay, and I'm easily available.
Yeah,
I'm mostly in town.
Okay, so your website again is what you said? Sorry.
It's stantatkin.com.
Yes.
And from there, that's a portal. You can get to anywhere from
that's
there, I think.
Tatkin, T-A-T-K-I-N.
T-A-T-K-I-N.
Yeah, yeah. And so you wrote Wired for Love and then Wired for Dating. And you have any other books coming out?
The first book was Love and War, Intimate Relationships. And there's an audio through Sounds True, which a lot of people love, called Your Brain on Love.
Your Brain on Love. That sounds great. Well, I think you're doing really great work. I think, yes, it sounds like you are using your own life as a research platform for helping people.
Oh, yes.
And you do help people because you, I think you help them face the reality of what a I mean, you're helping me of what a relationship really is.
And I believe we're all in this together.
Right. We are. One big relationship.
One big relationship.
Well, thanks again, Stan. Great talking to you.
And thank you for your patience. Sorry for the delay.
Oh, that's okay. We had a pretty good show there. So,
okay.
I mean, we filled that. No, I mean, it's nice to have the chance to just sit down and talk. So, yeah, this will be on YouTube. No, iTunes. This is
iTunes.
iTunes and, of course, bbsradio.com under New Realities. And
cool.
I'll just say I'm Alan Steinfeld with New Realities. And if you want to reach me, go to my website, newrealities.com. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alan.
Thanks, Stan.
Good night.
Good night.